Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
I'll be the first one to tell you that I think that our process of reviewing these cases has had some problems.
The state's lengthy review of police shooting footage draws criticism from the Assistant Attorney General. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 17th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, a Cook Inlet lease sale is on hold to consider the impact on endangered whales.
The Inflation Reduction Act is far more limited in scope than industry and its allies, and in this case, the state of Alaska, have been pushing.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. A panel of federal judges will hear oral arguments tomorrow in an appeal of a lower court ruling that threatened to halt the Southeast troll fishery for king or Chinook salmon. The Alaska Trollers Association, the state of Alaska, and other entities are appealing a Washington District Court ruling that found NOAA fisheries violated endangered species and environmental laws. The ruling says they did so by allowing the Southeast trollers to harvest king salmon at rates that harmed a small population of endangered killer whales in Puget Sound and several king salmon populations from the lower Columbia River. That ruling would have effectively stopped Southeast trollers from fishing for kings, at least until the National Marine Fisheries Service corrects its environmental analysis. But the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a stay on the lower court order in June of last year, allowing the fishery to stay open for now. The Washington-based conservation group Wild Fish Conservancy filed the initial suit 4 years ago. The organization's case rests on the idea that the trollers are intercepting salmon that would otherwise feed the Puget Sound killer whales. Spokesperson Emma Halverson told KFSK via email, quote, "Wild Fish Conservancy is committed to taking all actions necessary, including through the ongoing appeal process, to prevent the further decline of the southern resident killer whales and wild Chinook populations," end quote. A panel of 3 judges will hear the case in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals at around 8 a.m. Alaska time. State officials say they're working to improve the speed of their investigations into police shootings as public pressure mounts for the release of body camera footage of the incidents. So far this year, officers have shot 9 people during responses, killing 6 of them. 5 of those shootings involved Anchorage police. At a meeting with reporters today, Deputy Attorney General John Skidmore said the release of body camera footage should come after an investigation by the State Office of Special Prosecutions in order to follow due process. But he acknowledges that those state investigations are taking a long time.
I'll be the first one to tell you that I think that our process of reviewing these cases has had some problems. There are cases that we have reviewed that it has taken us in the Department of Law far too long to review.
Right now, the state is still reviewing 8 police shootings, including one from November of last year, to determine if use of force was justified. In some cases, Skidmore says, they're waiting on ballistic and police reports, as well as autopsies. To help with the delays, Skidmore says the Office of Special Prosecutions has more than doubled its number of prosecutors from 3 to 7. It's also working with law enforcement agencies to get reports from them faster.
I would always seek to talk with them first, and to encourage them and to come up with processes to help them get information to us faster. I think that will work. I'm very optimistic about that. But if it didn't work, are there other things that can be done? Yes, there are.
Skidmore says the state has investigated police shootings since 2009 and has records from 2010 on. Since then, there have been 148 police shootings in the state, and Skidmore says 0 of them have led to an officer being charged with a crime. That includes 2 of the shootings this year, one in Anchorage and the other in Wasilla.
We have found officers are not discharging their firearms unless it was authorized by statute. Now, that statute, that's a pretty broad authorization when they're allowed to do that. I'm not making any bones about that. That is a broad authorization. But those are the laws in the state of Alaska, and we haven't found anyone to violate them yet.
Under state statute, deadly use of force is authorized for officers when they reasonably suspect a person has committed a felony use of force against someone, is attempting to escape while armed with a firearm, or might, quote, otherwise endanger life or inflict serious physical injury unless arrested without delay. Skidmore says while he understands frustrated community members' calls for transparency, that must be balanced with protecting people's individual due process rights. Meanwhile, a federal judge is sending federal officials back to the drawing board after concluding a Cook Inlet oil and gas lease sale didn't adequately consider the possible impacts on endangered beluga whales in the area. As Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, the ruling temporarily suspends a lease held by dominant Cook Inlet producer Hillcorp.
Hillcorp was the only bidder in the lease sale, which was mandated by the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act. At the insistence of West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, that climate-focused federal law also included provisions mandating oil and gas lease sales in Cook Inlet and the Gulf of Mexico. A coalition of Alaska-based and national environmental groups challenged the Cook Inlet lease sale. They argued the Interior Department had not taken a hard enough look at the possible impacts of drilling on the endangered population of roughly 300 beluga whales that live in Cook Inlet. Oil and gas production creates loud undersea noise, and the groups argued that could interfere with beluga's echolocation. U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason agreed, but stopped short of vacating the lease sale entirely. She ordered the Interior Department to come up with a new environmental analysis and a range of alternative lease arrangements that could better account for the possible impacts on Cook Inlet beluga whales. And that could force the Interior Department to shrink or cancel Hillcorp's lease, says Earth Justice Attorney Carol Hawley.
This ruling just confirms that the Inflation Reduction Act is far more limited in scope than industry and its allies, and in this case, the state of Alaska, have been pushing. And it does not override NEPA or, you know, our other bedrock environmental laws.
NEPA is the National Environmental Policy Act. That's a Nixon-era law that requires federal agencies to evaluate the possible environmental impacts of their actions. Though the state of Alaska and federal government often clash on resource development, Alaska in this case intervened to support the lease sale. A Department of Law spokesperson said in a prepared statement that the state was, quote, disappointed with the continued uncertainty prompted by the decision. The spokesperson said the decision was, quote, counter to the intent of Congress in mandating the lease sale. Hillcorp is the only company with active federal leases in Cook Inlet, though federal data shows none of its 15 federal leases were producing oil and gas as of January. Hillcorp and the Interior Department did not respond to phone calls seeking comment. Oil and gas industry analysts point to long-term trends, including rising renewable energy production and higher production costs, as reasons for lackluster interest in recent oil and gas lease sales. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the first ever Miss Wheel from Amonik is crowned in Fairbanks.
With a total of 39 points, this year's Miss Wheel 2024, Tatiana!
That's ahead. Stay with us. One man is missing in the Northwest Arctic community of Norvik after a boat capsized on Monday night. According to a trooper dispatch, the boat was carrying five people on the Kobuk River north of Norvik. After the boat capsized, its passengers were able to contact locals by VHF radio for help. However, one passenger was still unaccounted for. The missing boater was identified as Brandon Sheldon, age 30, from the nearby village of Kayana. Dozens of volunteers from Norvik and nearby communities responded, as well as search and rescue teams from the Northwest Arctic Bureau, Alaska State, and wildlife troopers. The search is ongoing. Meanwhile, the Anchorage Police Department published a draft of a new body camera policy on Friday, and last night, the Anchorage Assembly, including Vice Chair Meg Zalatel, already had notes.
I think the revised policy is much better than the previous policy. I still think that there is room for improvement.
In a resolution the Assembly passed in a 9-1 vote, it asked the department for three things. First, to give body camera footage and other recordings related to the police killing of Christopher Handy on May 13th to his family. Handy's killing was the first in a string of three people Anchorage police killed across five recent shootings. Second, the resolution also asked the police to publish recordings of all recent critical incidents within 30 days. Finally, the Assembly wants the department to review other organizations' policies and to treat its denials to turn over recordings like other denials under the city's public records code with an appeals process and clear timelines. The Assembly and police have a work session scheduled for Friday to go over the department's draft policy. Chief Sean Case says he's looking forward to it.
The intent is, if there are any modifications, to make those and have the policy go into effect on Monday. Less than a week. Time to move.
Zalatel says she's optimistic the department will take the guidance to heart. The city of Homer secured funding for the second year of a study looking into the feasibility of expanding its harbor. KBBI's Jamie Deep reports on the process to get funds and next steps for the project.
Governor Mike Dunleavy signed the state capital budget late last month that put nearly $290,000 towards the study to pay for additional costs. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is leading the three-year study that looks at the current conditions of the city's harbor and explores potential options to expand it. The cost of the project is split between the federal, state, and city government. It also slowed down this year after the Corps announced increased costs and a lack of federal funding. Homer City Council member Rachel Lord says federal funding is also secured for the second year of the project. The remaining federal money is earmarked in the presidential budget, and she anticipates the funding will stay through the budget process.
Where we stand right now is a fully funded project to go through the completion of the general investigation.
The city also contracted engineering company HDR to study ocean conditions around the harbor. Jennifer Carroll is the special projects coordinator for the city. She says that the city expects to receive federal funds by the end of the month, where they can bring the project up to pace after the slowdown.
The city has been moving forward with contracting for some geotechnical work that is also designed to understand what the seafloor looks like, where we'll be proposing different designs of the harbor.
Part of the study is looking into whether expanding the harbor is a good option at all. At the end of the process, the Corps may determine the best choice is to take no action. Lord says the city will still get valuable information about the conditions around the harbor, as well as the needs of the local ship fleet.
We're going to have to figure out how to meet those needs somehow. So it's all going to be able to feed into really great movements for the community one way or the other.
While the study is underway, Lord wants the city to work with the community to understand what other services they can provide on the harbor. Carroll said in an email the Corps expects to begin designing proposed expansions in the fall. The team will hold a public meeting in the winter to get feedback on the designs. In Homer, I'm Jamie Deep.
It's been rainy in Alaska for much of July so far, with South Central set to see cloudy skies through the week. That comes on the heels of a drier than usual June, which sparked concerns as wildfires burned across the interior. As part of our Ask a Climatologist segment, National Weather Service climate researcher Brian Bretschneider says the rain is lessening the concerns over fires, and though temperatures may seem comparably cooler, it's still a warmer than average summer.
Obviously, rain is a great antidote for wildfire concerns, and it's been, it was actually, at least in South Central, it was fairly dry for the month of June. Actually, most of the state, it was dry for the month of June, and we were getting more concerned about the conditions that might be susceptible to starting fires, but this rain has certainly quite literally put a damper on that.
And speaking of wildfires, there were a bunch that were burning in the interior. You mentioned that a big chunk of the state has seen rain. Is the interior part of that big chunk?
Yes. I mean, so if you look statewide, the first half of July, we've basically had an entire July's worth of rainfall so far, on average, statewide. You know, places like Nome, it's five times as much rain so far that they should have had for the first half of July. And pretty much every single station is well above normal, with just a couple of exceptions. And so, the fires that were burning, I don't think there's any fire that was burning that hasn't gotten significant rain. I'm not sure if they're all out or not, but the rain has definitely been a blessing for fire. And also, July is basically the month of the year where we get the most lightning strikes by a wide margin. It's July, and then it's kind of June to a lesser degree, August to an even lesser degree. And with all these wetting rains, and they've been a kind of steady rains, not convective, not thunderstorms, not nearly as much. And that's also good for fires. And now we're really only a few weeks away from the end of the busy time of the lightning season. So there's not going to be too many more opportunities for new fires to start, hopefully.
We're coming to the end of what's considered sort of the peak of wildfire season, peak of lightning season. What is the rest of the summer looking like?
Well, the Climate Prediction Center, they do monthly outlooks. And the next outlook, which is going to be released on Thursday, will show that the southwest part of the state is most likely to be a little bit below normal temperatures. And then north and northeastern part of the state may be a little bit warmer than normal. And about half the state in the near normal category. A very familiar climate outlook pattern that we've seen a number of times over the last few months. And the August one looks to continue that trend. Also with above normal chances of being wetter than normal. And keep in mind, July and August are the two wettest months of the year in the mainland. So not southeast, but in the mainland, those are the two wettest months of the year. And so even near normal rainfall during those months is a good thing. It's a good amount of rain, and we potentially could be on the high end of that.
And this seems to be the second year in a row where the lower 48 has had baking temperatures. I've seen so many places that don't normally have above 100 degrees having above 100 degrees. Alaska having a, I don't want to say lackluster, but a less severe summer. It seems like an odd trend that, you know, as the lower 48 bakes, Alaska has a comparatively cooler summer. Is that normal?
Not really. There's a little bit more correlation in the winter, where there can often be kind of a flip between what Alaska experiences and what the lower 48 does. It doesn't really work out so much in the summer. So June statewide was a top 10 warmest June. It was also a top 10 driest June. We need to be careful now that we're in a kind of a cool, wet pattern to think, oh, this has been a cool, wet summer. It really hasn't been. In fact, for the first half of the summer, statewide, we're kind of exactly normal. The southwest part of the state is cooler than normal. The eastern part of the state is warmer than normal. But on balance, we're right at the 1991 to 2020 normal, which is warmer than, you know, previous decades. So historically, this is still probably a warmest third of all summers. You know, as far as rainfall, again, it was a very dry June. We're definitely making up for that so far in July, and the forecast looks for that to continue.
And that was National Weather Service climate researcher Brian Brettschneider. The Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage just finished up the final touches on a major renovation. The center now has four new exhibits and a remodeled main building adorned with sealskin lamps, custom carpet by an Alaska Native artist, and a mural modeled after porcupine quills. President and CEO Emily Edenshaw says the center made each renovation decision with a focus on community.
We really wanted to pay attention to the details and uplift our Alaska Native artist community. And I just love the outcome. It's so beautiful.
These renovations are just one stage of the center's celebration of its 25th anniversary. Edenshaw says the upcoming stages include plans to build a theater and a healing garden.
An elder named Norma Jean Dunn reached out to the Heritage Center. And she said, Emily, we need to construct and raise a healing pole that's dedicated to every single Alaska Native boarding school survivor, as well as their descendants and those who never came home.
After the garden is constructed, the center also plans to build a subsistence kitchen where Alaska Native people will have the space and resources to make fish strips, process a moose, and pass on thousands of years of Native knowledge.
We have so many Native youth that live in Anchorage who have never filleted a fish, who have never jarred salmon, who have never gone whaling, who have never walked on tundra. Every single Alaska Native person, no matter where you live, deserves to have access to your community and access to your knowledge.
The center has raised enough money to cover the new theater and healing garden. Edenshaw says she feels confident and hopeful that the center will be able to raise the remaining money for the subsistence kitchen and other updates. This month marks 10 years since the Kenaitse Indian Tribe's Denaina Wellness Center opened its doors in Kenai. The tribe held a celebration to commemorate the milestone and honor its strides in holistic care and indigenous healing. KDLL's Hunter Morrison spoke with tribal members at the event about the center's history and what may be in store for its future.
At the Wellness Center Friday, a group of tribal members perform a traditional drumming demonstration. Coupled with traditional dancing, it's part of the center's 10th anniversary celebration. What would later become the Denaina Wellness Center started as a small clinic in a strip mall in Kenai. It later grew to several buildings scattered around town, each offering different services. The tribal council first envisioned a comprehensive clinic in the late 1990s, later purchasing property in Old Town Kenai. The current center officially opened in 2014, offering dental, vision, primary care, behavioral health, and traditional healing services, all under one roof. According to its website, the 52,000 square foot facility follows a whole person approach toward wellness, addressing physical, emotional, and spiritual health.
We're able to really help our people and their families in a meaningful way because we address the whole person.
This is Marianne Mills, vice chair of the Kenaitse Indian Tribe.
And that's our Diné philosophy of care.
The center primarily serves Alaska Native and Indigenous people, but programs that receive state funding are open to all people. Today, the center has provided services for up to 8,000 Native and non-Native people. To accommodate a growing demand for services, the tribe is now looking for ways to expand. Here's Bernadine Atchison, Tribal Council Chair.
After the second year or so, we realized we had already outgrown the building. And so that's when we started thinking, how do we expand? And now we're looking at wellness, because that's a whole area of its own. So we're looking, that's kind of a future thing. What are we going to do with wellness? Because we really need to have a bigger area for them.
Atchison says the tribe is actively looking for new property to expand the clinic's services. About 100 people attended Friday's celebration. Attendees included tribal members, healthcare workers, and patients. Present on behalf of Governor Mike Dunleavy's office was Lieutenant Governor Nancy Dahlstrom. Here she is speaking about the Wellness Center with KDLL's Ashlyn O'Hara.
When I walk into some place and I hadn't been before, I mean, there's a very good feeling in that building, and you could tell that everybody there was, they were welcomed and welcoming everyone else, and I was thrilled to learn about all the different types of wellness.
Dahlstrom says the center's approach to modern medicine combined with holistic healing is vital to the health of the region. She says the state values the work and services of the clinic. Here's Marianne Mills speaking about the center's trauma-informed care.
You know, health care is just something that is so important, but it's more than just physical. It's mental, it's spiritual. And when you're able to combine the wraparound services that we have and the idea of, you know, the connection of the body, mind, spirit, and emotional well-being, I think it really helps with the healing of the whole person.
All Alaska Native and Indigenous people are eligible to receive services at the Dena'ina Wellness Center. The center is open 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday. In Kenai, I'm Hunter Morrison.
A college student from Bethel and Ammonek has been crowned Miss World Eskimo Indian Olympics. As KYUK's Sage Smiley reports, she says she's driven by a desire to practice and share traditional ways of life.
This spring, while the Kuskokwim River was still solid ice and the days were short, Tatiana Tanka Corthius was crowned Miss Chamai, winning the honor of representing the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta and celebrating Yupik and Chupik culture throughout Alaska. Now, in midsummer, as fireweed blooms, Corthius won the title of 2024 Miss World Eskimo Indian Olympics, or WIO, representing Alaska for the coming year. She was crowned at the Big Dipper Arena in Fairbanks on July 12th.
Let's hear it! With a total of 39 points, this year's Miss WIO 2024, Tatiana!
The 22-year-old student from Bethel and Ammonek impressed the judges with her traditional talent, personal interview, and impromptu speeches. In her acceptance speech, Corthius thanked her fellow competitors and reiterated her platform of practicing and celebrating Native culture and ways of life.
It's such an honor to be crowned the 2024 Miss WIO. I'm honored and excited to represent Alaska. My platform is to continue to uplift and advocate communities around the state, country, and Arctic.
In addition to the 2024 Miss WIO title, Corthius wins a $3,000 scholarship toward an educational opportunity of her choosing. She's currently a student at the University of Alaska Anchorage, where she's studying environmental science. She says when she graduates, she wants to continue advocating for the indigenous people of the Arctic. Corthius also won other honors for her traditional talent, as well as the title of Most Traditional, which was awarded based on personal interviews with judges. Her fellow Miss WIO contestants named her Miss Congeniality, a title she shares with second runner-up Jenilee Donovan of Utqiagvik, who's the current reigning Miss Top of the World. First runner-up was Ronnie Huss of Kotzebue, the reigning Miss Arctic Circle. Corthius's Miss WIO win is the first for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta since 2018, when Olivia Shields of Tuksuk Bay was named Miss WIO. According to Miss WIO records, it's the first ever win for a competitor from Emonik on the lower Yukon River. In Bethel, I'm Sage Smiley.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Shelby Herbert in Petersburg, Eric Stone in Juneau, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, Jamie Deep in Homer, Anissa Vitsa and Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Hunter Morrison in Kenai, and Sage Smiley in Bethel. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.